away. She winks at me and belts it out louder, and she's a terrible singer. So I start singing along with her, kind of self-defensively. And then we're dancing in unison, heads bobbing to the right, to the left, shoulders forward, shoulders back. Now we're yelling the words, and I'm pounding on the steering wheel, and she's got her arms in the air, and it's the best song I've ever heard. And now I'm smiling at her, and she's smiling at me. And it's a moment, a definite moment. She says, "Watch the road, Casanova." But she says it in this soft voice that I've never heard her use before. "Just remember, whatever we learn today, these tests don't change anything." I like the way she says "we," as if she's in this with me. "You're still Jack Maslin. You're still a pain in the ass. You're still you."
Libby. I am having a moment with Jack Maslin. If you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago, or even 2 days ago, if I could imagine such a thing, I would have laughed until I laughed the breath right out of me. This is the thing about life outside the house, though. You never know what might happen. I think he feels it, too. But I'm not sure. He'd better feel it, too. It had better not just be me over here, by myself, on my own, having a moment over him, as opposed to with him. I act like, "La la la, no big deal, let's go to Bloomington, let's see if you're really face blind." But inside my chest, my heart is clenching and unclenching, and skipping beats and fluttering like it's about to burst its way out of there and fly around this car. I fix a smile on my face and stare out the window and think, "Oh, heart, you traitor."
Jack. The lab is busy. An assistant leads us to Dr. Amber Klein. Light brown hair, sharp cheekbones, glasses. She's dressed all in black. Her sleeves rolled over her elbows, and her hair swept up in a kind of no-nonsense way. She's probably around 40. The lab is also black. Floors, walls, ceiling. The room is divided into cubicles by curtains. Black, of course. And it feels like we've wandered onto the set of a music video. Libby wears purple and I'm in green, and we stand out like beacons. Dr. Klein offers us chairs behind one of the black curtains, so it's as if we're enclosed in a small room. She boots up her laptop and says, "I understand you need to be home by late afternoon." She's wearing an actual watch, and she checks it now. 9:54 a.m. There's a bit of a curfew situation. I smile at Libby, and she smiles at me. She's still wearing the bow over her left ear, but her smile reminds me of the one my mom wore during Dad's chemo appointments. Like she's determined to make the most of things for the sake of him/me, when she knows how hopeless it really is. "I'm going to run you through a series of tests." Dr. Klein sits down and starts clicking away at the keyboard. Libby says to me, "I'm actually going to wait outside. I saw a Starbucks nearby. Just text me when you're done." She takes my phone and types her number in. When she hands it back, I feel this weird panic. She hesitates over my shoulder. "Unless, I mean, I can stay." But I can tell that she doesn't want to stay. And I wonder if maybe it's the whole doctor/brain setting that's bugging her. "Nah, I'm good." I watch her go, hair swinging. Dr. Klein says, "Does anyone in your family have prosopagnosia?" "I'm not sure. Why?" "Face blindness is often genetic, but there are three categories of prosopagnosia: acquired, developmental, and congenital. It can also be a symptom of other disorders, such as autism. Did you ever experience a fall or a childhood illness of the brain?"
"I fell off the roof when I was 6.
"Did you hit your head?"
"Could something like that cause face blindness?"
"Yes. It's not as common as developmental prosopagnosia, but it's possible.
I banged it pretty hard. Had to have stitches.
Instinctively, I reach for the thin, raised line along my scalp. She types away, and as she does, it hits me. This woman is going to dig around in your brain. You can't hide from her. She wants to know what kind of tests were done after I fell. And then she wants to know if I was able to recognize faces before the age of 6. The honest answer is, I don't know. Yeah, I had every test imaginable to see what damage had been done to my brain. But did I know people by their faces back then? I'm not sure. She says, certainly your parents would have noticed a difference if you suddenly had trouble recognizing everyone. I think I've always been good at compensating and covering up. I mean, even back then. Maybe I could recognize people before, but I was so young. Did your parents notice behavioral changes? My mom said they expected me to become this cautious kid, but I got louder. She says that's when she started going gray. I give her a smile, but she's busy typing. I sit there looking around, telling myself to man up, son, stop feeling nervous. In a minute, she folds her hands in her lap and begins talking. I'm not sure how much research you've done, Jack, but one of the earliest documented cases of prosopagnosia dates from 1883. Lewis Carroll was rumored to be prosopagnosic. The next time you read Alice in Wonderland, you might see the clues. I'm sure you're familiar with identifiers. As you know, hairstyle and clothing can change on a daily basis. We've met a lady who identifies people by their wedding rings, because this is an identifier that rarely changes. She's about to see everything you're hiding. Suddenly, I feel naked. I actually have to look down at myself to make sure I'm still wearing clothes. The first test is famous faces. This is similar to one I took online. Photos of celebrities with their hair and ears removed. Dr. Klein says, okay, Jack, the clock isn't ticking here, so feel free to take as much time as you need. She turns the laptop around so that I can use it. A face appears on the screen. It's just an oval, with eyes, a nose, a mouth. If I look at it long enough, it doesn't look like a face at all, but a planet pocked by craters and shadows. One by one, I type in the names. But to be honest, I'm making shit up. When I finish, we go right into the next test. Dr. Klein says, the system that processes reading emotions on a face is separate from the system that reads features. Can you typically tell if a person is angry or sad or happy? Almost always. I can't recognize faces, but I can read them. That's because there is a visual processing system that exists only for face recognition, and specifically only human faces. Your dog or your cat is actually identified by your brain as an object. The configural processor is what allows people to see the face as a whole, and not just its individual parts. This test is about identifying emotions. I want to think I nail every one of the answers, but I actually don't have a clue. Next is a series of upside-down faces. I'm supposed to match them to the right-side-up faces. But I can't. I know I can't. The more defeated I feel, though, the more energized Dr. Klein appears. She leans over the laptop. Humans who have no problem recognizing faces are very bad at identifying upside-down ones, because once you turn that image upside down, you can no longer use the configural processing strategy to recognize that face. So you start using a feature-by-feature strategy instead, which is how we identify objects. It's comparable to how you are with regular faces, because the human processor only works with upright images. Unlike monkeys, who are adept at recognizing other monkeys, no matter the orientation. The thing I take from this is, even monkeys recognize each other. Now we're going to test your ability with object recognition. This way we can know it's strictly a face recognition problem, and that it doesn't extend to objects. I sit there matching houses, cars, guns, landscapes, animals, and suddenly I'm thinking, what if I get these mixed up too? All these things I've never had trouble identifying? What if I only thought I recognized a cat, a dog, a house, a car, but I find out I don't know them any better than faces? I sit back for a minute and close my eyes, mostly because I want to get away from this computer, this lab, this campus, my own head. Dr. Klein says, I want you to remember that everyone gets some right and some wrong. It's how the test was designed. Which doesn't make me feel any better. But I open my eyes. I go on. I feel even worse with the next one. The bald women test. Which is photo after photo of regular non-celebrity females with the hair and ears missing once again. I'm supposed to hit a button if I see one that looks different. But they all look the same to me, so I don't even bother trying. I just hit same over and over. The last test reminds me of an eye exam. I lean on the chin rest and press my forehead against this contraption that looks like a mask. Dr. Klein wants me to study the computer screen, where there's a small camera pointed at my pupils. This, according to her, will record my method of processing a face. Normal perceivers go for the internal features of the face and use a triangular sequence that moves between the eyes, the nose, and the mouth. Prosopagnosics, on the other hand, start with the external features, such as the ears and the hair. They usually avoid the eye region. This sounds about right. And then I wonder what Libby is doing and where she is.
Libby. I'm standing in the Department of Brain Sciences Cognitive Neurology at Indiana University, Bloomington, where there are answers all around me. I was young when my mom died, and when my dad and I talked to the doctors about testing, I let my dad decide whether I should do it or not. But I'm here now, and I can ask to talk to one of these white-coated doctors or scientists. My mom died of a cerebral hemorrhage, and I need to know if I'm going to die that way, too. I'm pacing up and down the hall. If I'm tested, they'll either find out I have aneurysms in my brain or I don't. They will either be able to pin them off and try to control them or not. But here's the thing. Even if there aren't any aneurysms in there, these facts won't change. I will still be someone who watches. I will still be someone who is prepared and on the lookout, because at any moment, the earth could stop spinning. I've lived through the worst thing that can ever happen to me, and I know firsthand what the world can do. A man in a white coat passes by and nods at me. I nod back. I think, he could have answers. I watch him walk away. I think, if my mom was here, what would she say? My phone buzzes, and I almost don't check it, but it could be Jack. It's a text from JV. Libby plus absent from school equals questioning Atticus. I had one other thought. I realized that as bad as it is not to know, the not knowing is something, too. You can still do something with that. And then she adds, as much as a person can while a person's still in high school in Indiana.
Jack. I wait for Dr. Klein to run the results. I tell myself, it's okay. It's no big deal. I mean, it's not as if you don't already know that you suck at recognizing people. But listen, you do all right. You get by. You're good at figuring out identifiers, and you've done it all on your own without any guidance or help. I'm giving myself the pep talk of my life when Dr. Klein returns. She sits down across from me and says, "You're definitely prosopagnosic. Prosopagnosia is on a continuum. You can be mildly bad, or you can be profoundly face-blind. You are profoundly face-blind. In fact, you're one of the most severe cases I've ever seen." So, it's official. I expect to feel worse, or maybe even better now that it's confirmed.
What happens now? Is there a cure?
I haven't come across one in any of my research, but that doesn't mean Dr. Amber Klein, brain specialist, won't know of one. Her smile is upside down and apologetic.
We're certainly making great strides in our research, but no, there's no cure.
We're experimenting with ways to teach people how to better manage their face blindness. We've been doing some repetitive training with faces. Research subjects will train for an hour a week. There are 10 levels of difficulty. A teenage boy, a little younger than you, has been working with us for 5 months, and his eye movement strategies have become more normal.
Is he recognizing faces?
No, but we're hoping increased training will begin to help him in his everyday life.
She's starting to lose me, and she can tell this.
She turns around to reach for something, and when she turns back, it's as if she's a whole new person. The slate's been wiped clean, so to speak. The thing she reached for is a model of the human brain. She points to it as she talks. Toward the back of your brain, over your right ear, just here, there is a specific area that's responsible for identifying faces.
Fusiform gyrus 12. I reach up and run my fingers across the scar again, over my right ear.
We could do an MRI, and this would provide us with more information. Many prosopagnosics also have trouble recognizing cars and places. They often have topographical agnosia, which means they lose their way easily and don't recognize their houses or places of work. They can have trouble with their hearing. We think prosopagnosia is the key to discovering how the brain processes objects in general. For so long, we've thought of the brain as one entity. But we're learning now about all these separate machines, if you will, that are a part of its makeup. And the fact that these machines don't interact with each other, that they aren't even aware of each other.
Basically, the face processing area of my brain is either missing, defective, or unplugged. But if I do the MRI, there's still no cure?
Yes.
There's nothing more she can do for me. And I know that, and she knows that.
She says, I suggest telling people, at least your family. Let them know you have this. It will make things easier on you in the long run.
I pick up the phone and text Libby. I'm done. And I am.
One more thing, Jack. Most developmental prosopagnosics don't expect anything from the face in the way that those with acquired prosopagnosia do. Just as a person born without sight has only ever known not seeing, those who are born with this don't feel that lack in the same way. But for those who have acquired it, it's not out of the ordinary for them to keep trying to use the face as the key to recognition. That's the instinct.
For some reason, this is like a kick in the chest.
I did this to myself. If I hadn't climbed onto the roof that day, if I hadn't tried to show off, if I hadn't fallen, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to a brain specialist.
I should be heartbroken for 6-year-old me lying on the front lawn, my world changed forever. But instead, I just want to get out of here.
Thanks, Dr. Klein. I should get home. She shakes my hand, thanks me for my time, apologizes that she couldn't do more, as if it's her fault.
I want to tell her not to be sorry, that she's not the one who pushed me off the roof way back when. But instead I say, good luck with the research.
Jack, I turn back. I see a woman there with glasses and sharp cheekbones and hair swept up off her neck. She says, one person in every 50 is face blind. It might help for you to remember that. You're definitely not alone.
Libby. On the drive back to Amos, I ask him questions about the test, and he answers them in this very short, yes, no, yes, no kind of way. Then we're quiet. He is far away, and I know what that feels like, to want to close yourself up so I don't force him to talk anymore. We just ride. We ride for 10 miles without saying a word. The silence covers us like a blanket. I'm staring out past the road into the great beyond, but after a while the blanket of silence starts to feel smothering, like it's cutting off my circulation. I almost tell him I was this close to getting tested too. But what comes out of my mouth is, I want to be a dancer. Not just a damsel, but a professional dancer. To his credit, he doesn't go veering off the road. He echoes, a dancer. And he's still far away. But I can hear him tune in a bit. When I was little, not just young, but literally little, I took ballet. And I was great at it. I have this picture of me in a black leotard standing in the most perfect fifth position you've ever seen. It was taken the night of our recital, my first ever. And I was glorious. Afterward, my teacher told me, "You will never be a dancer. I can continue teaching you, but it will only be a waste of your parents' money. Your bones are too big. You don't have the body for it. The sooner you learn this, the better."
Wow. What a bastard.
It crushed me. For a long time, I didn't dance, no matter what my mom said. She offered to find me a different teacher, but something was ruined. I let that woman ruin it for me. I stare at his profile, fixed on the highway. But she can't stop me from dancing. No one's going to tell me not to dance anymore. No one should tell you what you can or can't do either, including you. We're riding in silence again, but everything is lighter and cleaner. The mood has lifted and he's back.
My dad is having an affair.
How do you know?
I just know. It's Mrs. Chapman at school.
As in Mrs. Chapman, chemistry teacher?
The very one.
Really? Except for being young, there's nothing about Mrs. Chapman that screams, "Take me for your mistress." And you have to see her at school.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to run into her at school.
Yeah.
What a bastard.
I'm sorry that people give you shit about your weight. I'm sorry for anything I did to make it worse for you.
I'm sorry you have to date Caroline Mouchamp. He laughs, and suddenly the car is warm and crackling with electricity.
I'm not dating her anymore.
These 5 words surround us, taking over the air until he says,
I'm sorry my friends can be assholes.
I'm sorry you can't recognize the people you know. Maybe if you could, you'd pick better friends. He laughs again, but not as hard. Look at it this way. Everyone you meet, everyone you know, if they get on your nerves or piss you off, it's okay. The next day they'll just be new people. Different people.
I guess.
He's not laughing now. We come up on a road sign. Amos, 5 miles. He says,
we could keep driving.
Into the sunset?
Why not?
And suddenly, it's like I'm watching us from the sky. 2 outlaws. Jack Maslin and Libby Strout, sitting together in the front seat of a badass mofo of an old car, his leg inches from hers, his hands on the wheel, breathing the same air, thinking the same thoughts, sharing things with each other that they don't share with anyone else. His eyes are on mine again, and he says,
as someone recently diagnosed with prosopagnosia, I'm told that I don't process faces like normal people. For instance, I avoid the eyes. But I don't seem to have any trouble looking into yours. In fact, I like looking into them. A lot.
Our eyes lock. As in, they lock. As in, I can't imagine ever looking away. The road, I say. But you can barely hear it.
Jack. I think about making a move on her. It would be so easy. Pull the car over, lean in, touch her cheek, lean in a little more. Close enough so she can feel my breath. Catch her eye, look right into her. Maybe brush her hair off her face. All the things I've learned to do in order to be the guy girls want. Her head is turned away so that I can only see her hair. When she speaks again, her voice sounds a little throaty, a little full. And there's something else in it. The something else is, she might like you back. Which means you might like her. Because to like someone back indicates reciprocating something that was already in existence. As in, you liked her first. As in, I like Libby Strout. Oh, shit. Do I? And because I'm thinking about cancer, and this old guy in San Francisco with face blindness, and Dr. Amber Klein, and aneurysms, and how, when you get down to it, so much of life is out of our control, I decide to take control of something. I reach over and take her hand. It's soft and warm and fits exactly in mine. And to be honest, I'm not really expecting anything. But suddenly my entire body is wired, as if I've been plugged directly into the sun. We stare down at our hands, as if we're seeing them for the first time. Somehow I remember I'm driving, so my eyes go back to the road, but I don't let go of her hand. I rub her skin with my thumb, and you can almost feel the electrostatic discharge, that flow of electricity between two electrically charged objects, suddenly coming into contact. ESD, as it's called, can create amazing electric sparks, but it can also have harmful effects, like coal dust explosions or gas. Unlike with Caroline, who was mostly gas and coal dust, there aren't any harmful effects here. Libby is solid. She's real. As long as I hold her hand, she won't vanish before my eyes.
Libby. He turns off the highway onto the Amos exit. We pass the Welcome Center and the Ford dealership and the mall and all the chain restaurants. We pass the old Victorians that line Main Street and the Little History Museum and the four blocks of downtown and the courthouse. We pass the high school and the college and the mortuary. And then, finally, we pull into my neighborhood. Do I like Jack Maslin? As in, like him? At some point, I'm going to have to get out of this car and move up the walk and open the door and go inside. I will have to shut that door, me on one side, him on the other, and he will move down the walk, away from this house, and climb back into his car and drive away. I will go to my room and lie on my bed and wonder if this really happened, or if I made it up, and how on earth I feel about it. He rolls to a stop and turns off the car, and we're both staring at our hands again. I don't look up because if I look up, he might look up, and what if he kisses me? My body might just explode into a million pieces of shimmering, glittering light.
Jack. I want her to look up. Look up, I think. Look up. Look up. My phone buzzes and we both jump. This is my alarm letting me know I only have 30 minutes before everyone gets home. Shit. She doesn't even wait for me to turn it off, just drops my hand like a hot potato and goes leaping out of the car. It breaks the spell, and I sit there thinking, what the fuck am I doing? I almost drive away, but instead I get out of the Land Rover, and she's already on her front step. For the first time this year, I can feel fall coming. There's a chill in the air that makes me think of bonfires. But my hand is still warm. I shove it into my pocket, and it burns right through my jeans to the skin. She says, "Thanks for bringing me home." And I can hear it. She's nervous. I look right into her eyes. "You are the most amazing person I've ever met. You're different. You're you. Always." Who else can say that except maybe Seth Powell, and he's an idiot.
You, Libby Strout, are not an idiot. She points at my chest.
You do like me.
What?
Jack Maslin likes the fat girl, but you haven't fully accepted it yet.
Okay, I think. Let's see where this goes. I'm not saying you're right. But what if I did accept it?
I guess we'd have to do something about it then.
And she walks into her house and shuts the door.
Libby. I stand inside, heart skipping beats. I can hear him on the other side of the door. I can feel him there. I know the moment when he walks away, 2 minutes later, because the air around me goes back to being normal air, not dangerous electric storm air that might lightning strike you at any moment. My heart is still skipping beats as he drives away.
Jack. I think about saying it as Mom passes the salad, as Dusty recites his lines from Peter Pan, as Dad passes the mac and cheese. I have prosopagnosia. It's official. I was tested today by a brain specialist. No one knows I haven't been home all day except Marcus, who keeps saying things like, wasn't it crazy when the fire alarm went off during lunch? Wasn't that crazy, Jack? All these baiting comments, trying to trip me up. When Mom and Dad aren't looking, I give him the finger. Dad catches me and says, Hey, not at the table. I want to tell him not to talk to me. I want to say, you're the last person who should be reprimanding anyone. But I'm in this weirdly good mood, in spite of Dr. Amber Klein, and in spite of my fucked up brain. So I don't say a word to my dad or to Marcus, which is so much more than either of them deserves. I stay locked in my own head, reliving the ride there, the ride home, my hand intertwined with Libby's, the way she smiled at me, and the way she said, I guess we'd have to do something about it then. After dinner, I'm in the basement, working on the Lego robot, trying to lose myself in the process of building something. But the only thing I'm building right now is the world's largest pile of discarded robot parts. The hardest stage of any project is coming up with it. Once I know what I want the thing to be, it's just a matter of collecting the pieces I need and putting them together in the right order. But right now, I can't nail it down. I've got 50 different ideas for 50 different robots, but none of them are right or extraordinary enough. I hear footsteps, and from the stairs a voice says, Were you really sick today? Dusty. Not in a flu kind of way. Do you want to talk about it? I'm good. He wanders over to me, sorting through the parts that are scattered across the work table and the floor. I say, Do you want to talk about anything? Are people still being shitty?
I'm good too. I'm Peter Pan.
And I get it. He wants to stay in this moment. The bad moments always have a way of coming around again, way too soon. I go up to my room and climb out of my window, into the tree and onto the roof. I lie back and stare at the sky. I think about it being the same sky that I looked up at when I was 6, before I fell, and about all that's happened in between then and now. It really shouldn't be the same sky, for all that's happened. It should look completely different. Marcus was playing in the yard. I went up to the roof to get away from him and away from my mom, who was always telling me to watch him. It was harder to get up there than I expected. That surprised me. And it was dirtier. Bird shit and twigs, and an old softball that might have been there for the past 20 years. Our roof isn't flat. It has a slope. And I scooted to the edge of it, looking out over the streets and the neighborhood. I held on with one hand, and Marcus looked up just then. And I let go because I wanted him to see that I was strong and fearless and bigger than he would ever be.
It takes less than a second to fall 12 feet, but it felt like it lasted forever. In that moment of falling, they say the memory goes wide open. You can see things you don't usually think of, or see, or remember. For me, it was my mother's face. Specifically, it was her eyes. I can't remember what they looked like in that moment I saw them. But I remember that I saw them.
Libby.
Hello? It's Jack. I was thinking about what you said.
I say so many things. Can you narrow it down?
I was thinking about what you said about doing something to address this whole you like me, I like you situation.
I never said I like you.
Silence.
Jack?
What you've just heard is the sound of my heart dying a swift and sudden death.
Hypothetically speaking, if, and I'm not saying I do, but if I was to like you, what would you want to do about it?
I would probably want to hold your hand.
Probably?
Hypothetically, yes. I would definitely hypothetically want to hold your hand.
Well, then, I would probably hypothetically hold yours back.
I would also hypothetically want to take you to a movie, even though I don't like movies as a rule because of the whole facial confusion situation.
Which one?
Which movie?
I need to know if it's something I want to see.
Won't it be enough just to be with me, holding hypothetical hands in the dark?
I'd at least like to know what kind of movie we'd be seeing.
I think it would need to be a movie with some of everything. Comedy, drama, action, mystery, romance.
That sounds like a really good movie.
So, would you hold my hand during it?
Probably.
Okay, I'll take probably for now.
I'd also want to take you out to dinner. Either before or after the movie, depending. And I would absolutely want to walk you to your door.
What if I wanted to dance to my door instead? Then I'm your man.
Are you? Is this what this means? My heart goes hopscotching out of the room and down the hall and out the door and into the street.
But after I danced you to the door, I'd want to kiss you.
You would?
I would.
And now my heart is nowhere on earth to be found. I can see it as it bypasses the moon and the stars and goes blasting into another galaxy.
Hypothetically.
Well, then, I would let you kiss me.
Hypothetically?
No, definitely. By the time we hang up 2 hours later, it's 1:46 a.m. I lie there for the rest of the night, waiting for my heart to return to my chest. The next 8 days.
Jack. At lunch on Monday, I sit across the table from Cam and Seth, who are elbow to elbow. I'm sketching design ideas for Dusty's robot, and I'm pretty much on fire for the first time. And I could see it. As in, I finally know what I'm doing, and my blood is pumping, and my heart is pumping like I've just run a marathon and sprinted all the way to the finish. Nothing, as in nothing, can stop the flow of these ideas. Until Seth goes, "You know, Cam and me, we've got something that can help you out in your situation." I look up, a little foggy, because my head is on the paper in front of me, not in the MVB cafeteria. Seth is grinning like a jackal, and whatever it is, I don't want to hear it. But I say, wary as hell, "What situation is that?" Seth elbows Cam hard, which makes Cam drop the 3 dozen French fries he was about to stuff down his throat. "God damn it, Powell!" Seth keeps right on. "I did some research last night." He pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket. "Jesus. Porn? I should have known. I go back to sketching. Not porn, God. He actually has the nerve to sound offended. Even though, as far as I know, Seth thinks the internet was invented for two purposes, porn and poker. Number one, they're easy to talk to. Who's easy to talk to? I'm still making notes. Fat girls! My head snaps up so hard I probably give myself whiplash. He's trying to keep a straight face, but he can't help himself. He's snickering already.
Two. Pretty women aren't always nice.
Cam goes, that one's true. I say, what is it you're reading to me?
Top 10 reasons to date a fat girl. I found it online.
He waves the paper and then holds it up to his face again. Reads something to himself and starts howling. I make a grab for it, but he holds it out of reach, over his head.
Three!
Cam rips the paper out of his hands and hands it to me. I crush it into a ball and get ready to launch it across the cafeteria into the trash, but I don't want anyone digging it out of there. So I stuff it into my back pocket instead. I lean over the table and whack Seth in the head. He just keeps laughing. Cam says, moron, and crams the rest of the French fries into his mouth. I know Seth thinks he's being funny, but my insides are burning, like I've inhaled an entire forest fire. Lay off her, man. I'm serious.
Wow. Sure, Mass. Whatever.
He's wiping the tears away and trying to catch his breath. He sits quietly for a minute, and then, with one snicker, he launches into another laughing fit. I try not to let it bother me. Who cares what they think? I tell myself it's not that she's fat. That's not what I'm worried about. I'm not worried at all. I just want them to leave me alone. Leave us alone. But part of me is going, what if you're just shallow? What if that's your identifier? You're a fucking idiot, Seth Powell. And I gather up my ideas and what's left of my lunch and walk away.
Libby. The damsel's drill team audition sign-up sheet hangs on Heather Alpern's door. So far, 7 girls have signed up. I'm number 8. JV hands me a pen, and I lean in and write my name. Behind me, I hear, oh my God, you're trying out? Caroline Luchamp looks down at me with this weird pretend smile that makes her look like some sort of beauty queen serial killer. I say, oh my God, how did you know? She blinks at me, blinks at my name on the sheet, blinks at JV, blinks at me. I say, just imagine it. We could be teammates. And then I squeeze her into the tightest hug. See you at auditions. JV can barely walk for laughing. She weaves like a drunk person through the halls. Finally, she straightens up and stops laughing long enough to say, so, what did you do about the Atticus situation? Test or no test? No test. I decided he knew best after all. He usually does. In driver's ed, we're assigned 3 to a car. And since the rest of the class is made up of sophomores, the lone juniors are lumped together. Bailey, Travis Kearns, and me. I'm pretty sure Travis is stoned. He carries on a commentary in the back seat that goes something like, floor it, big girl. Go like the mother effin' wind. Open her up. Show this world what you can do. Take that beautiful big leg of yours and slam that gas pedal. Take us to the moon, sister. Or at least to Indy. Take us to Indy. Take us to Indy. Indy, Indy, Indy. Several indecipherable words followed by mad laughter. Bailey is in the back next to him, and she's smashed up against the door, as far away from him as she can possibly get. But in true Bailey fashion, she's wearing a determined smile. Mr. Dominguez, in all his manliness, is in the passenger seat. I'm behind the wheel, and I can't help it. I'm excited. My hands are tingling, and there is this crazy heat burning up from my feet, all the way up my legs, into my stomach, through my chest. I feel like I'm on fire. But in a way, it lets me know I'm alive. You have to understand that for a long time, there was a part of me that thought I would never drive, or run, or do any of the everyday things that people my age get to do. My world consisted of my bed and the sofa. And after a while, when I couldn't move easily from one to the other, I stayed in bed all day and night, reading, watching show after show, surfing around online, and yes, eating. Sometimes I would hear Dean, Sam, and Castiel outside, and if I sat up enough, I could see out my window into the street and watch them play tennis, or soccer, or tag. I saw Dean and Sam leave for dances and dates. In my mind, they were dating me. I watched the youngest, Cass, climb one of the trees that hugged the house. I overheard phone conversations and makeout sessions and arguments. Sometimes I'd see Cass in my yard, looking up at my window, and I would sit very still, hoping he'd go away because it was one thing to spy, and another to be spied on. So now I'm driving, which is why I don't mind that Travis is nattering on or that Bailey is asking me about Jack and me, and is there anything between us that means something, and is there a Jack and Libby in any way, shape, or form that she should know about? Mr. Dominguez barks directions at me, and at some point yells at the two of them to shut up. Even though this is my first time behind the wheel, I'm good at it. Like it's effortless. I feel at home here. And at some point, it hits me. I'm driving. As in, I'm actually driving a car. Like a normal person. Like that person passing me on the other side of the road. Like the person in front of me. Like the person behind me. Like all these people walking down the street who probably have cars and licenses of their own. I am driving a car! This is one more thing I'll never get to share with my mom. And before I know it, I'm crying. I miss her. But look at me behind the wheel, steering us down the street. Look at me waiting at the stoplight. Look at me making this turn. Mr. Dominguez says,
"What the hell are you doing?"
Without taking my eyes from the road, I say, "I'm crying and also driving. I'm crying and driving." This makes me cry harder, and the tears are both happy and sad. Bailey leans up and gives my shoulder a squeeze, and I can hear her sniffling. Dominguez goes,
"Do we need to stop the car?"
"Never. I want to drive for days." Suddenly, I'm talking only in exclamation marks. And then I check my mirrors, and even though Dominguez hasn't told me to, I go beelining for the highway entrance because I can't hold myself back. I need to turn this car loose. Travis yells, "Floor it!" And Bailey lets out a little squeal as she goes flying back against the seat. I'm still crying, but now I'm also laughing because I'm free, and none of them can possibly understand. "You will never know what it's like to be trapped in your house like a veal," I say to Mr. Dominguez. "This is the best day of my life." Even to me, my laughter sounds maniacal. But it doesn't feel that way. It feels big and sincere and endless. Like I could laugh from now until the end of my life without interruption. And as ridiculous as it sounds, I mean it. This is the best day of my life. I'm on the highway now, and everything is whooshing by, but then I start whooshing along with it all, just like everyone else, like I actually belong out here in this world. Like I could drive all the way up into the clouds, propelled by happiness and freedom. Someone turns on the music. "All Right Now" by Free, In the rearview mirror, I can see Travis airbanging his head, and poor Bailey clutching at my seat, blonde hair blowing everywhere. The song plays on and on as I practice passing in and out of lanes, long enough that eventually all of us, even Bailey, sing the chorus. 2 blocks from school, Mr. Dominguez makes us roll up the windows and sit up straight. But as I pull into the parking lot, we're all still singing.
Jack. After the conversation circle, Libby and I walk out of the gym together. We walk up the stairs and through the halls side by side, and then we walk out to the parking lot. I want to hold her hand, but I don't. And my brain grabs onto this with both fists. Why don't you hold her hand? Kishan, Natasha, and the rest of them are ahead of us, so it's just Libby and me. I say, I was wondering, hypothetically speaking, if you'd go out with me this weekend. She either pretends to think about this or actually thinks about this. Take your time. You've got approximately 2 more minutes to respond. Until the offer expires. Until I ask you again. She gives me a smile that's all slinky and seductive. In this low voice, she goes, I think hypothetically, it sounds like fun.
Libby. Jack is 5 minutes early. His hair is as wildly gigantic as usual, but damp, as if he just stepped out of the shower. And I'm sitting next to him on the couch, and he smells like soap and so much man. I try not to stare at his hands resting on his knees, at the way his skin looks even more gold against the dark blue of his jeans. I've warned my dad that Jack is coming, that Jack is my friend, that Jack is taking me out for my first date ever. Yes, the same Jack you met in the principal's office. I hold my breath as we sit, the three of us, four counting George, blinking at Jack from the back of my dad's chair, in an awkward triangle of so many things not being said. My dad and Jack are making chit-chat, and Jack does most of the talking. My dad watches him like he's trying to uncover his true intentions. He isn't necessarily being warm and friendly, but he's not being rude either, which is something to be grateful for. But then, Will Strout goes,
You can imagine how surprised I was when Libby told me she wanted to go out with you.
I can.
I know my daughter's amazing, but the question is if you do.
I'm learning that.
She seems to trust you, and she wants me to trust you too. I understand why you wouldn't. All I can do is try to prove myself to both of you, sir. Can you give me 3 good reasons I should let her leave the house with you tonight? I acted like an asshole, but I'm not an asshole. I never meant to hurt your daughter. I would never purposely hurt your daughter.
Dad looks at me, and I try to give him a look that says, please forgive him and let me go, so that I don't die an old maid, and besides, I really like him, even if you think it sounds crazy, and please, please trust me.
He says to Jack, So, where are you planning on taking my daughter this evening?
He keeps saying my daughter like he's trying to drive the point home. This is my child, my flesh and blood. Do you know how dead you will be if you do anything to mess with my only kid?
I thought we'd see a movie and get something to eat. You'll bring her home by 11 o'clock.
Me? I'm a junior in high school.
Dad? Yes, you are.
Me? How about midnight?
Dad? How about 10:30?
Me to Jack. I need to be home by 11. Jack, laughing.
Not a problem. I promise to get her home by then, if not before.
Not too much before, I think. My dad says to him,
When was the last time you had your car serviced?
And now I can't tell if he's just messing with Jack or if he's being serious. I try to send him a telepathic message. Please stop this. Please lighten up. There's a good chance he's going to destroy my chances here before I can. And maybe Jack isn't my last opportunity to have a male non-relation love me, but he's certainly my best opportunity right now. And besides, I actually like him. I like Jack Maslin.
August, I'm actually pretty handy, so I did it myself.
Dad studies him for what seems like the rest of my life.
You know, your father and I went to school together. We played on the football team in middle school and in high school.
And it's not exactly, I'm so thrilled you're taking my daughter out, but it's something. In the car, I say, I'm sorry about my dad.
Are you kidding? He has every reason to kick my ass. If I was him, I'd never let me near you.
But all I hear is, I just want to be near you, Libby Strout. I want to kiss your lips right off your face.
Jack says, he's just protective, and he should be, especially after what I did to you. That's how I'd be if I ever had a daughter.
But what I hear is, I will always be protective of you. I will always look after you and our daughter, the one we're going to have together after we get married, and I am loving you forever. I'm in the same car, only 15 years in the future, somewhere far away from Amos. Jack Maslin is next to me like he is now, only our kids are in the back seat. Or maybe just one kid, the daughter. My hand on his leg. I stare at his leg, and then at his hands on the wheel. I bet you'll be a wonderful father. I'm not sure where we're going, but we're headed to the east side of town, where the restaurants and the movie theater are. This is where my dad and I lived until they had to destroy our house to get me out. As if he can read my mind, Jack says, "Didn't you used to live on this side of town?" Once upon a time. So where are we going? He grins at me, and I melt into the seat. My insides have gone warm and soft, and I lean into this feeling because it's not something I have all the time. It's okay to be happy, I hear Rachel say. It's okay to let yourself enjoy the good times. Tonight could be the night. My Pauline Potter work off the weight sex night. Jack Maslin, you just might be my first. He says,
I was thinking we'd get something to eat and take it from there.
But he might as well say, I'm taking you to the moon and back, and while we're up there, I'm going to collect the stars for you so that you can keep them. And suddenly, I'm thinking about the daughter we're destined to have. Beatrice, I think. We'll name her Beatrice. We drive past Olive Garden, Applebee's, and the Red Lobster that opened last month. I'm mentally ticking through all the restaurants in town. There aren't many, but we pass one after the other. I half expect him to just circle around and take me home. No food, no date. Or maybe drive across the Ohio line where no one will recognize him, or me, or us. But then we're leaving Amos, and my heart deflates a little. Which tells me I didn't actually expect him to do this, and now he's doing it, smuggling me over city lines like the daughter of some wealthy oil baron. Where are we going? My voice sounds flat, as if it's underridden a semi about 50 times.
Richmond.
Richmond? It comes out sounding like, are you effing kidding me? Richmond? Why don't you just chain a boulder to my leg and throw me in the river?
Yes, Richmond. There's no way I'm taking you to one of the usual dumps in town. Not looking like that.
Jack. Clara's Pizza King is an institution. It's the best pizza for miles, and there's a red double-decker bus parked in the dining room. The place is crowded, but I've called ahead. We can sit in the bus or at a corner table upstairs that has a porch swing on one side. Libby chooses the porch swing. We move through the tables, Libby in front of me, and I see people staring at her. This happens when I'm with Caroline. People look at her. But they look at Caroline because she's the kind of tall, sexy girl you look at,
As we walk, I can see where the path is too tight, where Libby will have to squeeze through.